The Senate Judiciary Committee is back to order. We have in front of us Senator Torres Rey.
All in favor.
Senate File 2855.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. Thank you for the opportunity to come before your committee. We are reviewing provisions in sections 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 of this bill, Senate File 2855. This is Article 3, excuse me. And so in your bill, if you have the, I think it starts in page 19, but most of what we are going to cover today will be page 23. And 24, so sections 6 to 8 related to court jurisdiction. And with me, I have Ms. Erin Sullivan Sutton from DHS, who will be going through these provisions and answer any questions you may have.
Ms. Sullivan Sutton, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Erin Sullivan Sutton. I'm the Director of the Division of Child Safety and Permanency at the Department of Human Services. The sections that you have before you are related to changes in federal law that were passed by Congress in 2008 with the Fostering Connections to Success Act, which allows for federal financial participation to help support the cost of placement for children who remain in care between the ages of 18 and 21. Under current Minnesota law, kids are to be given the opportunity to remain in care until they're until 21. Most don't, but for those that do, it's currently 100% a county cost. With the changes that were passed at the federal level, the FFP would become available on October 1st of this year, which is why we're proposing the changes before you today. We have not yet received regulations from the federal government. They don't know when they're coming. So the proposals that you will see before you today would carry out the protections that federal law requires for kids up until their 18th birthday to apply to those same protections for kids 18 to 21. So the first section of the bill, Section 4, is simply a cross-reference, correcting a cross-reference in the statute that's not related to the fostering connections. Sections 5 through 9 are those sections that relate to the federal law I mentioned. Section 5 simply amends the definition of child in the Juvenile Court Act to include youth who remain in care until age 21. Sections 6, 7, 8, and 9 have to do with the protections I mentioned and eligibility requirements. Section 6 would extend court jurisdiction to age 21 for those children who choose to remain in care. As I said, that's a very few children. Most recently we looked, there were 72 children in Minnesota who are in care beyond the age of 18. We don't think that the number will change significantly, but I wanted to give you a sense of the scope. Section 7 would require the court to annually review a case when a child remains in foster care until 21. That's a current requirement for kids in care prior to their 18th birthday. There's annual reviews that are required. Section 8 updates references and requires the court to review the progress toward independent living related to the child's transition from out-of-home care into adulthood. It also makes changes to have the court review the plan but not make specific findings on each and every element in the independent living plan. That was something that was making specific findings was something that was passed, I believe, a year or two ago. That became very problematic for the courts to implement. And so this would allow them to have the same information without requiring the specified findings. Section 7 provides for the specific benefits for foster care, the eligibility requirements and for those children who are in care 18 and to 21 and would comply with the federal requirements. And that's essentially the provisions that you have before you. I would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions for Senator Torres Rey or Ms. Sullivan Sutton?
Madam Chair.
Senator Lemmer.
Ms. Sutton, you said that this was a result of federal legislation?
Ms. Sullivan Sutton?
Ms. Chairman, Madam Chairman, Senator Limmer, yes. The Congress amended Title IV-E in 2008 to allow for Title IV-E to be used to support the cost of out-of-home placement for those eligible children who remain in care between the ages of 18 to 21. And this would allow Minnesota to draw down the FFP to support the cost of those placements.
Help me understand, Ms. Sutton. We have an age of majority at 18, and how does the relationship go beyond 18 up to 21? Are these kids special needs individuals, or help me understand why we go beyond 18 years of age?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, that's a very good question. Two components. One, the Minnesota Juvenile Court Act defines kids in foster care until age 21 and allows for that. But specifically on your question of eligibility, one of the eligibility criteria, or the eligibility criteria for this population of children, are that children are remaining in care and are in an education program. They are participating in a program to reduce barriers to employment. They are employed, or they're incapable of employment due to a medical condition.
And, Madam Chair, one other question I did have is we get a lot of direction from the federal government. It seems like it's growing every year. What would happen if states said no, didn't want to participate? Are there consequences? Is there money that wouldn't be handed down to the state? What would happen if Minnesota just opted out of this federal program?
Ms. Sullivan Sutton.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, we are not required to use the FFP for keeping kids in care from 18 to 21. So the legislature could decide not to adopt these provisions. However, not adopting the provisions would mean that you would lose federal resources that would otherwise be available and free up some, frankly, county money because they're paying 100% of the cost of placement. Now, we do have to meet the eligibility criteria and the requirements of the Title IV-E program to be able to participate in that program, which is in the tens of millions of dollars. And we have to submit a state 4E plan and adhere to those provisions.
Yeah. Well, thank you. the more I understand some of the federal mandates that come down, or even the federal offerings, we as states probably don't discuss enough whether we should say no or not. We just kind of rush for the money. And maybe this year we're a little bit under the weather a little bit monetarily wise. But I like to ask why and what would happen if we said no. And probably should be something states should do. Well, in my opinion, states should ask those questions more and more. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Ms. Sullivan Sutton, could you go through Section 9 of the bill with us?
Excuse me. Article 1.
Starts on page 26.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, members, the first section is actually current law, but it's relocated into the section in which a county is required to notify a youth 6 months prior to their 18th birthday that they may remain in foster care until age 21 if they choose to do that. Subdivision 2 provides for the agency in conjunction with the child to develop and update the independent living plan for a child. Again, this is a current law. Independent living plans are required for all kids ages 16 and over. Subdivision 3 provides the eligibility criteria for those children to remain in care between 18 and 21, and this language is consistent with the federal law passed in fostering connections that I mentioned a few moments ago.
And this is not current law, or it is current law? This is new language.
This is new language. Under current law, the reasons kids would tend to remain in care are very much along these lines, but this is puts it our law in conformity with the federal language. Subdivision 4 clarifies that foster care benefits are basically the maintenance payments made to foster parents for supporting the care of children, and include benefits available for youth who are living in a supervised setting independently, and that's something that the federal law has allowed for the first time with the fostering connection decision. Subdivision 5 is consistent with current law in that permanency decisions are to be in the best interest of the children, and there are criteria set forth in state statute eight factors for determining what's in a child's best interest. And subdivision 6 provides for the independent living plan to be developed and implemented for a child until they're 21, if they remain in care until they are 21. Some may not remain in care for that long. And subdivision 7 clarifies that the court is to retain jurisdiction for kids who are in foster care under this provision. And that, again, is a federal requirement. I can tell you that child welfare directors have been providing input to HHS, and we've actually strongly recommended that there be flexibility here so that it would be recognized that in some instances the court may need to retain jurisdiction, but we also think in a number of situations it may be appropriate for there to be a voluntary agreement between the youth and the agency, but we don't know that they're going to accept those recommendations, and so we've recommended that at least for now we continue the court jurisdiction because that is required for current 4E.
And this is new language to help with the implementation of the federal law.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Okay, very good. Any other questions for Senator Torres-Ray or Ms. Sullivan-Sutton? Is there anybody else who's going to testify on the bill, Senator Torres-Ray?
No, Madam Chair.
Anybody else here who would like to testify on this bill? Senator Olson moves that Senate File 2855 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor. Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm not supposed to vote on that one.
What did you say?
I said aye too, Senator. I'm not
supposed to say voted.
Aye. Oh.
Hold on. I moved to reconsider.
Division.
You're not the first. There have been others who voted on their bills. Senator Kielash?
Don't go voting.
No, he's been through and he came back. Senator Kielash, has there been a decision made in Senate File 2559? Are you going to go forward with it?
Yeah, that's ready to go forward.
But he's still a new guy.
He's
a fresh.
So Senate File 2559. I was thinking about the other one. All right, we'll take 2559.
Should we take this one? Should be the one we can get through quicker.
Madam Chair, 59? 20?
Yep, 2559.
50, okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, during the 2009 legislative session, a law was enacted that permits a mortgager or owner of property postpone foreclosure sale on the property under certain conditions. The idea behind this was that giving people more time to reinstate could help more people keep their homes by giving them more time to gather the necessary funds to make payments. The law currently provides for a postponement of the sale by 5 months after the original scheduled date of sale. Unfortunately, last year's bill inadvertently only dealt with 6-month redemption periods. This bill, Senate File 2559, recognized that some properties may be subject to a 12-month foreclosure redemption period rather than the standard 6-month period. It provides for mortgagers or owners subject to that longer redemption period to postpone the date of a foreclosure sale by 11 months rather than 5 months, as would be permitted under the newly enacted law. The changes would apply to foreclosure sales scheduled to occur beginning 30 days after final enactment of this bill, and the properties subject to the 12-month redemption period are generally agricultural homestead properties.
Any questions for Senator Kielash?
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
What kind of property has a 12-month redemption period?
Some of the
Senator Kielash.
Some of the agriculture properties, the homestead. 10 acres and above, and less than 40 acres, just It has a little more commercial use. I have that here someplace.
Good enough. Okay. I'll move the bill.
Senator Betzel.
Thank you.
The effective date being 30 days after the date of final enactment, what I'm not quite sure what that purpose is.
So there's time to adjust, I think. This is a House bill. I know I'm not supposed to say that.
My head.
He means to say.
I move that be strict.
Senator Betzel, this is. This is another lawyer's bill, so I have trouble dealing with all the legalese on some of it, but that's
where Ms. Pontius, do you know why some bills would have a 30-day?
Madam Chair, that's somewhat unique because it is a little confusing to try to calculate the exact day, but I assume they didn't want it to be day following but didn't want it to be August 1st. I mean, you could pick another, June 1st or May 1st, depending on how fast it gets signed into law.
Or 30 days after.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, I mean, you can ultimately figure out when 30 days after the governor signed the bill is, or you could just put in, a date so that there's a little more clarity in doing that. I mean, I can understand why they may want to not wait until August 1st, but... under most circumstances, I think June 1st, under almost any circumstances, this bill, if it's going to be passed at all, should be passed, signed by then. But I don't know. I mean, this is not my proposal, so I don't know what the intent is here.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, I believe that because this was an overlooked kind of mortgage from last year, cleanup language to make sure that all the mortgages were included. I think that's why the 30-day was chosen.
Madam Chair, Senator Keelash.
Senator Betzel.
That doesn't make sense. I don't get it.
So that it's quickly adapted as part of last year's mortgage, stretching out the redemption period.
They would have liked it to be immediately effective, immediately upon enactment, mm-hmm. but because that may not be practicable, they made it 30-day, as opposed to perhaps if this passed and became law, in the next couple of weeks, that they would have to wait till June, I think, perhaps. So,
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel,
Senator Keelash.
We could have a few more foreclosures and mortgages and a lengthier time, I would think.
Senator Lemmer.
Madam Chair, Senator Keelash, what you're trying to do in this is make a residential home foreclosure sale fit a 12-month redemption period and make it similar to agricultural land. Is that correct?
No.
Senator Keelash.
Madam Chair, this is essentially extending it out to those properties that are allowed 12-month mortgages or mortgage redemption periods. It changes. Last year's redemption law did it for 6-month mortgages. This 12-month mortgages was considered an oversight, and these properties should be included in that extra extension. Redemption period.
So as a result of this, will we have any properties with a 6-month foreclosure period?
It does not
still?
Change that part of the law.
It does not.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I think, Senator Limmer, there are properties that already have the 12-month that today. Not that we created them last year. They just
Is that created happened. By a mortgage
it's in the
deed and that's already pre-written into a contract that supersedes state law?
It is in the statutes.
It is?
It is in the statutes.
Senator Limmer, there are certain types of properties. There are certain types of properties that are 6-month. And there are certain types of properties that are 12-month. So when we made the change, we only allowed the change for the 6-month properties. And we left out the 12-month type properties. But they're both residential homestead type properties. So the question that was asked to Senator Keelash was, what type of property are the 12-month properties? And he stated that these are the smaller acreage farm homestead properties.
5 to 10 acre.
Yes. So, all right. Any further discussions on 2559? Senator Olson moves that Senate File 2559 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Senate File 2539.
580.23 sub 2.
Madam Chair, I have an author's amendment.
Beyond that, heck, I don't know.
A1.
Senator Olson moves the A1 amendment as an author's amendment to put the bill into the shape the author would like it to be in. We can put it in shape and then you can talk about it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails.
Madam, the bill as drafted went a little further than intended. The changes in the amendment will take out conditional language that states that the association may not deny services to a unit owner who fails to pay their dues only if those services would endanger health and safety for properties. As drafted, the bill allows for withholding other services that was not the intent of the legislation. In addition, the amendment will reinstate much of the stricken language in lines 323 to 326, and with the exception of the words non-payment of assessments or on line 325, those words would remain stricken. In this case, more language was stricken than intended. The full deletion would go beyond what this bill was trying to accomplish. Madam Chair, this bill was brought to me from an association of properties located in a former resort land that turned into a common interest community. There are 54 lots in the development, but 32 of them were purchased by a business that is now planning to cease payment of their association dues. And since they control the majority of properties, there is very little the association can do to require payment because of can do to require payment because any such motions could be voted down by this majority owner. Further, this majority owner has expressed interest in trying to amend the plat boundaries and change the association rules. Since they have 32 votes, there is little the association members can do. I understand that there are other common interest communities dealing with numerous members who, for any number of reasons, are not paying their dues, but do keep their votes. This becomes a concern for those associations where the majority of unit owners are unwilling or unable to pay their dues, but still can cast votes in the association, leaving the association stuck with the bill for projects that the majority of voters are not paying for. The intent is exactly what it says, is to take some of the control out of those foreclosed properties or those properties that have not been selling in development areas and or where people are not paying their dues by taking away their voting rights. They cannot vote against the best interests of the folks that are paying the dues.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Kilosh, I guess I understand saying that they can't vote or seek election as an officer, but page 3, line 5 says that the association can suspend any right or privilege of a unit owner, except they can't deny them access to the unit and they cannot withhold services. I think suspend any right or privilege is rather broadly worded. I'm not quite sure what that means. Does that mean that, you know, you can't park your car in the parking lot? Does that mean, I don't know what it means. I mean, it could mean whatever the board of directors chooses it to mean, because we can suspend any right or privilege. What is intended there?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, one of the difficulties in trying to draft language is the different kinds of associations, everything from condo associations, townhouse associations, or even associations in some developments where there is a series of fourplexes, et cetera, that are united by the original developer. And without the ability to restrict benefits to those units that are not paying for the assessments that are required, everything from trying to assess for a roof replacement on a building to redoing the roads within the development or everything in between. There are some cases where associations have abused it, and I realize that. It's been brought to my attention on some of those issues as well. What I'm trying to get to is the point where a single owner or a group of owners that are unwilling to pay the cost of the association and the bills the association accumulates have the ability to vote for increasing those bills and or changing the original the original documents that the homeowners bought when they moved into the plotted land, similar to the case I just mentioned. So,
well,
I'm not sure that I have the right balance, but I'm trying to get to the point where homeowners are not being taken advantage by a property owner that was unable to sell the rest of his lots or units.
Chair, Senator Kelosh, I mean, we're trying to write a whole law based upon a situation you're describing. I can tell you that there's some of these homeowners associations where the board of directors just runs amok. They just think that they've got all the power in the world, and they run roughshod over all the residents. And so if you got one homeowner that is delinquent 1 month in paying an assessment, that board can suspend any right or privilege of that unit.
Madam Chair,
that's not right.
Madam Chair,
Senator Kelosh.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, I agree with you that's not the intent. I'm not trying to increase the rights the current boards have over their tenants. What I'm trying to do is keep one of the pieces of language I thought about, but I didn't have time to check and see about the is if a single owner owns a majority of the units, they're allowed one vote in that association, so they cannot essentially, what in one of these cases, the owner of the 32 units is raising rates on the assessments to all the others, all the other owners, to help pay for maintaining his property that is not yet sold or developed, because he has the votes to do that, so they're paying their assessments. This would just take away his ability to vote increased assessments on the minority where he is the one that's benefiting from it. If we could just keep it to a majority, I'd be glad to do that, but I'm not exactly sure which language restricts it to that kind of situation.
So Senator Kelosh, though, if the owner that is obstructing the process is the majority...
he owns the majority of units?
The majority, and... So then he would have to participate to suspend his own right to vote. Then he would say no, and then they wouldn't be able to suspend his right to participate because he would have to participate in the initial vote.
Correct, Madam Chair. And so you've got this kind of a catch-22. The homeowners are being dominated by the – and they can't even change the rules in order to make sure that he's not abusing their – own assessments to feather his pockets in that case.
So, Senator Kelosh, then I don't know how this bill helps, because in that circumstance...
It includes a little more than it should, but that particular circumstances is one of many kinds. Like I said, there's others where a number of homeowners refuse to pay the assessments but then vote for improvements to the properties. There's no way to get... to balance that currently in law, and obviously you can't do that through the Homeowners Association when there's a majority there that can vote that can't happen.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I know that condo associations like this can foreclose on units for lack of paying the dues and assessments and junk. How does that fit in
to this? Madam Chair, the majority owner can, Senator Higgins, the majority owner or the owner of the majority of the units can say the association will not do this to me. So because he's got the control of the votes on the association. The association needs to have enough votes to say we are going to go into foreclose on these people that aren't paying. With the majority of the votes coming from people who are not paying their assessments, you can understand why they would not vote to allow the association to sue to have their homes taken away from them in the foreclosure or lien process. That's part of the dilemma these associations are running into when people aren't paying their assessments and have the ability to vote for improvements on that or increase the bills to the rest of the tenants, the unit owners.
Madam Chair?
Well, Senator Higgins is asking a question. Ms. Dunleavy, why don't you come up to the table? Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, does somebody who owns multiple units have a vote for each unit?
Yes.
Oh.
So.
Oh, that didn't work. No.
Mr. Dunleavy, perspective.
Madam Chair, I'm the co-chair of the Legislative Committee of the Real Property Section, and we've got the Real Property Section has a particular committee that deals only with condominium issues. And Tom Bray, who's at my right, is one of the attorneys that's on that committee. He's a condominium attorney. I'm just an ordinary real estate attorney, so I think he would be more qualified to give you a perspective.
Just, but not ordinary, Mr. Dunleavy. Right. Mr. Bray, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have served on the committee that Mr. Dunleavy referenced since 1990, and I think during that period of time we have considered this concept at least two and I think maybe as many as four times. And each time our committee has come to the conclusion that we could not include this in Mac-Iowa because of our concern that the concept allows the Board of Directors to deny property rights without any due process. You know, and this is similar to the situation of any creditor. In this situation, the association is the creditor. They're trying to collect a debt from the unit owner, and they want to be able to put, gain leverage over that debtor without having to go to court and get a judicial determination that the debt is actually fairly due and owing. And that's a significant concern for our committee because there are situations, especially involving fines, where the association will levy a fine. There will be a good faith dispute between the association and the unit owner as to whether that fine is appropriate or not. But once that fine is levied, it becomes an assessment, and now we have an association that has the right not only to levy the fine, but also to now start enforcing remedies without any judicial process. That's a significant concern. Also, I think some concern in terms of the denial of access language, there would be some other issues that would need to be covered. But our primary concern with this sort of a provision is that giving the association the right to take these property rights from the unit owner without any due process.
Madam Chair.
Senator Kielash.
He's addressing an issue that is fine as long as there is an association that has the ability to foreclose on those folks that are not paying their assessments. But what the problem is that when majority owners that aren't paying assessments and or a single owner that owns a majority of the units has the ability to keep the association from taking any action against those that aren't paying their assessments, it leaves the whole association in a impossible situation. The owner of the 32 properties has the ability to change the very nature of the development that he purchased into because he's got more votes than the association. They bought the property with this design property, and now he has the ability because he controls more units than the residents of the property. The person doesn't live, obviously, in all 32 units, has more power than the association that lives in that. So it's kind of... I'm trying to get at not the individual problem where there is association that is abusive, but rather where the opposite, where non-paying members have more control over it than the paying members in the of that association.
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair and Senator Kielash, what if we were to change the approach to something I think you maybe referred to earlier, with just the idea that a person doesn't get more than one vote no matter how many units they owned?
Is that something, I mean, I wonder what the other gentlemen think about that, if that's been discussed in your meetings.
Discussed about
Would that be too radical of an idea?
Senator Hulash.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, it solves those positions that we have, many more of them, you know, because of the financial crisis in the housing market. And so we see much more of this kind of problem. But it doesn't address the issue where individuals that own all of their units, the majority of which are not paying into the assessment, but are still voting in a association as if they are, and in fact could be voting to increase the association fees on everybody that is paying. Because
Mr. Brame or Mr. Dunleavy, given those circumstances, you have a majority owner who is not paying the assessments, but they can't get kicked off the association because it would take a majority vote of the association to kick them off, and they're the majority. So what avenues are open to the rest of the other members of the association now that the association has sort of been taken hostage by this renegade majority member?
Madam Chair, you know, I obviously don't understand enough of the facts of the specific case that Senator Hulash is describing, but in general, a couple of observations. First of all, the association is not run by the individual unit owners. It's run by a board of directors elected by the unit owners. And that board of directors has duties to the owners, and among which are the enforcement of the governing documents. And so even though a particular unit owner may own a majority of the units, which would then allow them to control the election of the members of the directors, of the board of directors, those directors are still individually and personally liable to all the owners of the units in the project. And if they were to fail to enforce the association documents, individual unit owners can bring a suit against those individual board directors to force them to, in effect, do their job and enforce the documents. So I think there are remedies available under the existing act.
Senator Limmer?
Yes. I was going to the first thought that I had is that if this even was passed, I'm not sure if this is the remedy that would cure your problem. There's existing contracts in the form of the association that the property owners sign, and there's in some ways a contract for services. It doesn't necessarily obligate the payment of an assessment, but an association fee. And even if it wasn't, even if it was, I'm not sure if this would suspend the contractual rights that were written maybe many years ago. And you don't have a retroactive reference to it going back in time, so I'm not sure if that would even be enforceable. It would only be enforceable in a prospective manner. Now, I may be wrong on that, but and then the other, and Senator Betzel caught one too, that if an owner failed to pay even a single assessment, all rights and privileges would be suspended. I'm not sure if an assessment is in the form of the total dollar amount that's owed or if it's a monthly payment. And you're taking away that individual's right to vote, which also goes back to the original association duties, obligations, and responsibilities of both the association and the owner of the individual unit. The right to vote is rather a sacrosanct element, I think, in this type of relationship. So I'm not sure if this is really I can certainly understand the frustration that the people in this association must have with this majority owner. I've dealt with this before in other real estate transactions, and usually not in this blatant of a manner, but maybe it's just the sign of our poor real estate times that was he planning on selling these, or was he holding it and then just renting them out?
The original, Madam Chair,
thank you, Lash.
Remember that the original owner of those of the development either was foreclosed on or sold. I don't know the exact circumstances, but so a new owner came in. He owned 32 units and the voting rights, and he is essentially forcing the
board to change the plots to maybe he's adding an extra lot, changing the very nature of the development that was sold to these owners originally. And even though that they're the people living there, they're the people that are in each of the units, they have absolutely no control of what a person who is not in the units is going to do to the property around them and surrounding their community. So that's the part where it gets a little dicey. And when payments aren't made by a majority of the people with the ability to vote, that keeps them from even proceeding with foreclosure or collecting on liens or all the documents that are given to the owners and the association up front to protect them from people that aren't taking care of their obligation to the association and the community.
Yes. Madam Chair, the assessment, is it like a maintenance bill that has been left unpaid, or what is this assessment?
Madam Chair,
Ray?
Senator, typically there are various types of assessments in a homeowners association, but the most common, which is often referred to as the annual assessment, you basically take the budget for the association for the year, which includes insurance costs, potentially real estate taxes, maintenance costs, and divide those among the owners based on the formula that's set forth in the declaration.
Right.
Madam Chair.
Senator Kulash.
Senator Limmer, on top of that, if the condominium needs a new roof, the assessment would be that person's portion of the new roof. So that could also be a reason for owner to have an objection to paying the assessment. So that's some of the issues that we're dealing with. But in the end, the roof needs replacing, and it affects all the other homeowners.
Senator Limmer. In the case of a repair item like that, and if it was hired out, you might have a case for a lien, a mechanic's lien on it. If it was whether or not that majority owner would even grant the repair, and the roofs are slowly degrading to the point that it's ruining either his individual units or maybe a collective, you know, one big roof over everything, then you got another problem. It's one of these things that I don't know how the legislature can fix this yet. I'm not sure.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I think one of the things that strikes me is when you have a majority owner that's not paying assessment, he kind of becomes a landlord for the people that are there because they are at his mercy. Yeah. And in the case where a majority of those people in the association are not paying their dues, they also become, you know, the minority becomes captive by the majority's will and the ability to collect enough assessments to even do the maintenance on the property can be a part of the problem. And some of these are not necessarily vicious attempts to or angry people angry. Some of it is just plain the economics of losing your job and losing hours in your work and those things to where the assessment becomes very difficult to pay. And those cases that I understand where leniency, and that's what these gentlemen are trying to prevent that from happening to a homeowner. It's the reverse when the majority has the ability number one, add assessments to a smaller group that is living there and have complete control of the property.
Madam Chair, this reminds me of when one would sell a multi-family residential units, and the developer holds ownership in the units he does not sell, and as you sell the units, his involvement, his ownership becomes smaller and smaller. And he eventually sells all the units out, and it kind of metamorphoses into an association owned by the residents.
Right.
And in this case, the timeline is kind of backwards. For whatever reason, this guy's owning the majority of the units, and then it's not moving. It's not changing, and he's not, I think you're right, he's become a landlord, so to speak, but he's become a de facto property manager that isn't involved in the property. Maybe the local city jurisdiction could claim some safety and hazard issues or health issues in at least the maintenance side of it, but and then impose something there. But I'm not sure from a contractual way how it would have to go back and alter the original contract, or we would have to affect the original contract, and I don't, this bill doesn't go there, so I'm not.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer.
Senator Kulash.
The idea is to have a statute in place that doesn't allow this to happen to homeowners, and like I said, if there is one person owning the majority of units, if that person was allowed to have one vote instead of the 32 because he's not actively in the units, that would be one way of addressing it. What I'm looking for is some kind of limit to what that person's ability to control the rest of the association is.
Madam Chair, the one thing that I would state that maybe a property disclosure that's supposed to mention the matters of fact that would affect the ownership of a property, maybe these individuals may have a little bit of an angle there if they were failed to disclose the ownership potential. I'm not sure, but that doesn't fix the house or anything else, but it does give them maybe a remote cause of action.
Senator Kulash, I think that we understand the situation you're trying to address. I don't know that the bill does that for you. But, Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, perhaps these gentlemen could say whether or not there's anything in the act that deals with one owner having an impact, let's say, on the value and or the resale of another unit. Because certainly if you knew, because I think all of this has to be disclosed to a purchaser, if you knew that you could be paying assessments that weren't being distributed equally by, and this was all controlled by someone who wasn't paying the assessments, it certainly has an impact on your ability to sell your property, I would think. I mean, is there anything in the act that where someone is impeding that ability to transfer?
Senator Kulash.
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, what I think the best intentions going in, the documentation gives all the rights to the property, and I believe a book was kind of suggested that it's very thick with all the association rules and documents of possible redress of grievances, things like that. And the intent was on this in this case was that all the properties are sold, so that therefore those rules and assessments go into place, and they make sense. But when they're not sold in this economy, for example, or the market is overbuilt, you end up with a situation where folks' lives are being controlled by somebody else.
Well, I'm sorry.
Senator Shack, go ahead.
I'm not concerned about the person who owns all these units being able to sell. I mean, obviously, that would be helpful if they could. To everybody's situation. I'm talking about the people who are affected by this, the people who are paying their assessments and their ability to sell their property. I would think it would be sorely affected, or somebody, you know, might have an action against them if they sold and didn't tell them the reality of that association. I don't know.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Individual units that are owned separately, but if let's say you have a neighbor who didn't take care of their property and it was so run down that it affected either your value or your ability to attract a buyer, would you have a cause of action against that neighbor?
Madam Chair, I'm asking if there's anything in the act, not in this bill, but in the Common Ownership Interest Act, that addresses that kind of situation, I guess, or does it just relate to the board and the association?
So, Mr. Bray, the question is, are there disclosure requirements that requires disclosure of this kind of circumstance to vulnerable buyers who are coming into this situation?
Madam Chair, you know, again, not understanding all the facts of the situations, there are certainly some disclosures that would be relevant. For example, many of the budgetary disclosures, you would have an idea of what is the financial health of the association? Are people generally paying their assessments? Are they not? In terms of disclosure of ownership percentages or ownership volume, there is no, you know, that's a matter of public record, but that is not something that's required to be disclosed, and that would be difficult to disclose because it'd be difficult to go and obtain that information. I'm not clear in the situation that we're talking about whether this is a developer, someone who has taken over the developer role, in which case I think there are many specific provisions in the Act that could be used to prevent this sort of thing. Or if there's someone who has bought after foreclosure and maybe has foregone the developer rights and therefore wouldn't be construed as a developer, although I still believe that there are remedies under the statute that could address this.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just, you know, it seems like Senator Kelash has raised some valid concerns where there are actual people facing a problem that isn't being adequately able to be addressed under our existing law. And as he pointed out, since he's not an attorney, when you come and talk about, you know, kind of the bar's position or the group of attorneys practicing in this area, it's not such an easy thing for him to respond to. But, you know, it does seem that if this isn't the solution, that there needs to be a remedy. And I guess, you know, I know our time is limited as far as this session and the amount of time we have left to pass bills, but it seems to me like there either needs to be a discussion going forward with changes to the bill to try to address this, or else I don't know if it would be better to lay it aside for a little bit and try to work this out. But you're saying that there is a remedy for the people in his situation, and they haven't been able to find it, and somehow I don't know if we can fully get to the bottom of that right now.
Senator Kelash, would you like a vote on your bill?
Madam Chair, I'm open for recommendations because, quite frankly, I don't know what might be. I know it's difficult to get into your committee, and I'm guessing I probably won't get another shot to try to fix this and come back in, but I'm going to leave that to you.
Okay. Well,
I
think it's your call. If you like a vote on the bill, we'll take a vote on the bill.
I think it needs fixing, so I would rather try and do a fix, but then again, I'm guessing that I would have to wait till next year, or will I have an opportunity to come back before the committee?
Can't tell you that, because we're heading up against deadline week, and I mean, if somehow you can survive deadline, you know, we could maybe bring you back.
Let's do a vote on
next week.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, then we'll lay the bill on the table.
Okay.
Or would you like to move the bill?
Lay the bill on the table.
Okay.
Thank you.
Then we'll do that. Thank you.
Thanks.
Senator Higgins.
The old property. I'm a co-op.
You're already on the agenda.
Oh. Senator Higgins, Senate File 2549.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to offer some amendments to put this in the shape that we think it should be looked at. We'll delete section 2 and 4.
Is that the A2 amendment, Senator Higgins?
Oh, I forgot. We actually have an amendment.
Yeah. So Senator Higgins moves the A2 amendment as an author's amendment to put the bill into the shape she would like it to be in. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, last year we worked on a whole collection of housing-related bills, and one of the things we did in one of those bills was to amend the window of time within which an owner of a property or a holder of a sheriff's certificate must secure a building that is open to trespass. It had previously been 6 days, and for some strange reason, we changed that to 14 days. And that has caused significant problems for cities. They find a property that is open to trespass, they send a notice to the owner or the holder of the sheriff's certificate that the property needs to be secured. And in that amount of time, people can get in and steal things from the house, cause great damage to the house and whatever. So changing it from 6 days to 14 days is has caused some real problems. So this bill, Section 1, would change it back to 16 days. Section 2 was deleted in the author's amendment. Section 3 requires that the notice that goes out to one and all actually include contact information of a representative of the mortgagee or the assignee of the mortgage who has the authority to negotiate a resolution of the foreclosure and respond to property maintenance concerns. So somebody who could actually go hire somebody to make sure that the house is secured. Section 4 was deleted. And then Sections 5, 6, and 7 all kind of work together. And it allows the courts to award reasonable costs and disbursement to cities for the costs that are associated with requesting a redemption period be reduced to 5 weeks, which is something that we enacted last year to allow the cities to actually make that request. And with the author's amendment, we think that this mirrors now what the attorneys can ask for reimbursement for costs and disbursements as well. I have with me this evening Grant Wilson, who is the manager of the Problem Properties Unit in the Department of Regulatory Services in Minneapolis.
Mr. Wilson, welcome to the committee. Would you like to state your name for the record, please?
Yes, my name is Grant Wilson, and I am manager of the Minneapolis Problem Properties Unit in our Regulatory Services Division. I am here to ask your support for Senate File 2549, as it will greatly improve the tools that we need to stabilize our problem properties. In Section 1, the waiting period to secure an open vacant building is in this bill will be reduced from 14 to 6 days, as it was since 1996. The important factor here is Chapter 582.251 requires the holder of a sheriff's certificate to keep an abandoned building secure. This bill in Section 1, Chapter 463, is the remedy that cities have when they do not comply. Plus, it's the main tool we use to secure all vacant buildings, not just the abandoned buildings. So I'm just asking for your help in supporting that bill. It will help us greatly. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Is there anyone else here who would like to testify regarding this bill?
Hi, Kevin. How are you?
Hi.
Hi. Just restate your name, please.
I'm Kevin Dunleavy. I co-chair the Legislative Committee of the Real Property Section, and I have been working with Ms. Reed on this legislation. And I think the one thing that I'm concerned with now is just the publication part in Section 3. And I'm certainly happy to work with the author and Ms. Reed to try to address my concerns. And the concern that I have is that right now, this notice, the language is in paragraph 7, would be a page 2, line 206. The notice language there is the notice that goes to the foreclosure counselors. That doesn't get published now. It doesn't get served on the property owner. So now that this name, address, and phone number would have to be published in a newspaper. And then the second part of it is new language. It's not in anywhere in existing law, and that's to have somebody to respond to property maintenance concerns. The problem with that is the lender, the mortgage holder, really doesn't have a right to do anything to the property until they own it, with the exception of they can foreclose it, they can secure it if it's vacant. There's a statute that allows them to winterize and secure it, and they can do a 5-week redemption period. So I don't know that the mortgage holder has anybody that can respond to the property maintenance concerns until the bank actually owns the property. So I don't know that there is anyone that fits that language that can be disclosed. And secondly, I'm not sure that it's appropriate to be published in a newspaper. So that's my remaining concern about this.
Senator Higgins or Mr. Wilson, would you like to respond?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. In so many cases, we send notices to the taxpayer of record, for example. We send notices on many things, on maintenance issues, on nuisance conditions, on open buildings, and the notices come back unopened because the property is in foreclosure. Some bank owns it somewhere. We can't find these people. Sometimes we can, after 2 days of research, find a bank in Kentucky that says, yep, that's in our portfolio, but the man who has the keys or the power to find a plumber to winterize this building to stop the water from flowing won't be around till next week. We really need some help in finding who these people are. We're mailing hundreds and hundreds of notices now in this mortgage crisis to people that have long since abandoned the property. And so some help like this notice requirement, even if it's an email from the bank that has it to the city clerk of any city, would really be helpful.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Higgins?
I would submit that if you are a neighbor of the property that is in foreclosure and the grass gets up as high as an elephant's eye, and you know it looks awful. There are people who have moved in. There are maybe the plumbing is all clogged up, and you're living next to a real problem. You would say that whoever that lender is who foreclosed on it does have an obligation to make sure that that property has at least minimal maintenance. You know, what we passed last year in the limited right of entry says that the holder of the mortgage or the sheriff's certificate shall enter the premises and make reasonable periodic inspections, install or change the locks on the doors, on the windows, and ensure that any existing window locks are functioning, and may, to protect the premises from waste, trespass, or falling below minimum community standards for public safety and sanitation, enter the premises, board the windows, doors, other openings, install and operate an alarm system, and otherwise prevent or minimize damage to the premises from the elements, vandalism, trespass, or illegal activity. So that that holder of the sheriff's certificate, the mortgagee, clearly by Minnesota law, does have an obligation to this. And if we can't find him, we can't get it done in any other way than hiring a crew to go do it and then assessing it to the property.
So, Senator Higgins, it sounds like what you're saying is, sounds like Mr. Dunleavy said they don't have that authority, but you're kind of reminding us that we gave them that authority last year, specifically in statute. And so to clarify any this is just a suggestion, and I'm just wondering what your response would be to that, both of you, to clarify that's what we're talking about. I wonder if it would be helpful if we said something like tying the requirement back to that specific language. So if we said in respond to maintenance concerns of the city or town in which the premises is located,
under the authority given
with
582.03.
Yeah, in accordance with the language of that statute, and just made that a insertion, then clearly we're tying that to statutory authority that exists in law. And I'm just wondering if Mr. Dunleavy thinks that would clear up the concern that he had about that.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure who's chairing the committee now, but
I guess I still am.
Okay. Madam Chair, the creditor has been given some rights to do this, but they don't have a legal right. They don't have an obligation to do it, and they don't have the right to control the property until they own it. If you want to require them to do things, that's a different legal concept, and I think that there's probably due process concerns when you start telling somebody you don't own this property, but you have an obligation to do this.
But Mr. Dunleavy, we already passed that law.
The language is discretionary from the last session. They have the discretion to do some things. The statute is may. I have it in front of me. They have the right. Okay, they're if they know that there's abandonment, then they have to do some things. They have to secure the property. And they have the discretion to also do these other things. But that's all premised on actual knowledge. It's not automatic. It's not a legal requirement that they have to do these things.
But, Madam Chair, if we don't have some way of knowing who can do the maintenance, it never gets to that point. And that's the point of the amendment in Section 3 is, you know, somebody has to be in charge, and, you know, this is providing a mechanism for the city, the locality, to actually know who's in charge. And, you know, once we can get the information of you know, who's in charge of this property while it's going through the redemption period and foreclosure, then, you know, we can actually maybe have properties that are better taken care of.
Thank you. And Sarah Higgins, I agree with you. It doesn't seem to me that any language in there says anything has to be done or not done. It's just the notice of making sure you know who to deal with. I'm wondering, though, does this does the person who has the authority to negotiate a resolution of the foreclosure and respond to property and maintenance concerns, does that add substance to what you're doing? I mean, is that necessary language? Because might it be a different person than the representative, the mortgagee, or an assignee of the mortgage?
I didn't understand. I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Well, in other words, if you're getting the name, address, and phone number of the mortgagee or the assignee of the mortgage, is that person all automatically the same person that would have the authority to negotiate a resolution and respond to property maintenance concerns, or do we need that language in there to make sure you have that information?
I don't understand. What did she say? Are these necessarily the same people? Are they the same people? Is that what you're asking?
Senator Higgins, that's right. I guess I'm just asking do we need that language, or is that just sort of, is that causing the problem because we're adding that language, or is it needed?
Madam Chair, the language that says or respond to the property maintenance concerns, that language?
Right.
I'm having a hard time figuring out where you're going.
If you look at line 2.27 and you're identifying who the mortgagee or assignee of the mortgage person of the I'll withdraw my question because I think I've just kind of figured it out in my own mind. They could assign a different person to be carrying out these duties, and that's why you need to know specifically who that person is who has those duties to either do the property maintenance or negotiate the resolution. Is that why we have that additional language beyond just the naming the mortgager?
Yes, Madam Chair. There would be I think there would be times that maybe one of the great big banks, call it Wells Fargo, you know, they probably have somebody
in the region who can look after their buildings. I think they've talked to enough cities that they, you know, they have somebody who is somebody who can be called to go deal with it. And yet, probably not the person that you would put in this. You would you may put Dunleavy and Associates, you know, the law firm who is you know, doing the foreclosure action for the lender. You'd call them, and then they'd say, okay, our client's contact person is so-and-so, and we'll call them and tell them to go deal with it. Or, you know, maybe a lender, you know, your law firm has to have a contact with somebody who's the lender, and, you know, that would be the connection. Okay. And that's, I think, why there are two okay. different pieces of that sentence.
Do the members have any other questions? Is there anyone else here who wanted to testify?
I'll find out if there is, if it's possible to get
Senator Higgins, are you ready to move your bill?
Yeah, let's find out. Let's keep it.
Madam Chair, we were just talking there. There may be a little more research that we can do on that particular issue of it, and we're both happy to do that. But at this time, I'd like to move the bill, and I think it just goes to the floor unless anybody knows any better.
Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 2549 be recommended to pass and referred to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
That was a quick gavel.
Oh, the gavel comes after. Opposed?
None. Just a refresh.
Motion.